content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 12, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in a gray, large capital block lettering, superimposed upon a black background. It is a black and white portrait that is featured on the cover. A distinguished, albeit elderly looking gentleman, garbed in white. Again, this is a black and white photo. The white is not bright. The white is muted. He has a skull cap. He has a large silver-looking crucifix around his neck. He is smiling amiably. It is Pope Francis, 1936 to 2025. The first article is The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, The Trump, Taiwan, and China Puzzle. Since the inaugurations of William Lai, or Lai, L-A-I, as Taiwan's president in May 2024, and Donald Trump as U.S. president in January, Beijing has been on edge. Will Lai take provocative actions that demand a response? And what is Trump's attitude toward Taiwan and its fight to remain outside China's orbit? The answers have proved complicated. In the early days of his presidency, Lai carefully avoided riling Beijing unnecessarily. The strength of Taiwan's economy last year appeared to relieve him of any political need to rally his nationalist base with fist-shaking actions or rhetoric toward the mainland. But his Democratic Progressive Party lacks a parliamentary majority, and he cannot be sure the Trump administration has his back. Whatever his political intent, Lai has become more strident on cross-Taiwan Strait questions in recent weeks. March 13, Lai delivered a speech in which he proposed 17 steps Taiwan should take to counter threats posed by China and its bid to infiltrate his government and Taiwanese society. Predictably, Beijing one-upped him with 18 pieces of official commentary via state media that attacked Lai and his plans. 2 weeks later, he was denounced as a danger maker, and China's People's Liberation Army released propaganda videos simulating a blockade of the self-ruled island. If that was too subtle, China's Navy conducted joint exercises around Taiwan April 1 to simulate an assault on maritime and ground targets and a blockade on key areas and sea lanes, according to a PLA official. The Chinese Coast Guard deployed vessels in a circumnavigation patrol around Taiwan. We have seen similar moves and countermoves in the waters between China and Taiwan many times before. But this time, both sides are trying to decipher what the mercurial Trump really thinks. For now, Taiwan needs to safeguard its economy against Trump's tariff pressures. Lai's negotiators held their first trade talks with the White House April 11, a day after Bloomberg published an op-ed by Lai that proposed a reciprocal zero-tariff regime with the U.S. and an increase in purchases and investments in the U.S. Lai then called on April 14 for a Taiwan plus the U.S. framework to help Taiwanese companies relocate and expand into the American market. Though we do not yet know his tariff intentions toward Taiwan, Trump is extremely unlikely to cut it loose, at least in the next term. Yes, he has made clear his flexibility on territorial integrity, see Greenland, Denmark, Panama, and even Canada. If he will not take on costs and risks to help Ukraine repel Russian invaders, how confident can Taiwan be that Trump will commit U.S. troops and taxpayer funds to defend an ally thousands of miles from American shores? At the same time, Trump has filled his cabinet with China hawks. And if there's one U.S. ally most every Republican in Washington wants to defend, it is Taiwan against China. Beijing knows a full-scale invasion would risk direct war with the U.S., a destructive gamble for China's already wobbly economy at a time when Trump has added 145% tariffs to its burdens. For China's leaders, it is much safer to hold off on a full-scale invasion until the military balance more decisively favors its forces. Its economy is on more solid footing, and the U.S. is led by a more predictable president. The real risk is that China will test U.S. resolve and probe Trump's responses with incremental escalations of pressure on Taiwan, none big enough on its own to create a crisis. Would it were that simple? As U.S.-China relations further break down, the shutting down of key lines of communication between Washington and Beijing could enable any accident or miscalculation to escalate into a full-blown military crisis that both would much prefer to avoid. The View Inbox, Health Matters, by Alana Samuels, senior correspondent. Mere hours after birth, most newborns are tested for two things: whether they have signs of hearing loss and whether they have a range of rare conditions that could severely affect their health and their lives. If they test positive for either, they qualify for a number of interventions that can dramatically improve their prospects over their lifetime. But both tests could undergo dramatic changes under the Trump administration because of drastic cutbacks at federal health agencies that public health advocates say imperil applicable programs. These cutbacks could mean certain states will not test for and respond to conditions that currently set services into motion. There are a lot of worthy causes that fall by the wayside when there is not some kind of centralized government support, says Carl White, director of the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management at Utah State University. One program facing cuts is the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Service, EHDI, which is run partially out of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. The program helps states coordinate newborn hearing screening and respond to infants who fail the hearing tests. It falls under the CDC's Disability and Health Promotion branch. But this entire branch was eliminated in the April 1 cutbacks at CDC that slashed about 2,400 employees. EHDI had 8 full-time workers and 1 fellow. All but 1 were dismissed in the cutbacks, according to current and former staff. EHDI worked with states to analyze data to help communities follow up with families so that babies born deaf or hard of hearing got support as early as possible. Under the program, states apply for funding grants under EHDI. They submitted the applications to the CDC in January, and now the applications are sitting unattended with no one left to review them, according to White. There are real questions about what's going to happen, White says, and whether that money is going to be available. Newborn hearing screenings are a true public health success story. Hospitals did not start screening children for hearing loss at birth until the 1990s. It was not until 2000 that screening was nearly universal across states. Children's lives can be changed dramatically by early screening and response. In the 1970s and 1980s, children were not diagnosed with profound hearing loss till they were 2 or 3 years old, which hampered their ability to read and write, White says. Now children are screened at birth, and early interventions can help them meet more of these milestones. According to a survey conducted by White in early 2024, 18 states said their EHDI programs would be discontinued if federal money disappeared. Though hearing testing may continue at hospitals, there would be a gap in the coordinated response and interventions for affected babies. Some EHDI funding is still administered through the Health Resources and Services Administration, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, that was less affected by cuts. But the HRSA funding relies on EHDI data, and it will be impossible to know where problems lie and where to send money. Newborn hearing screening is not the only testing program being cut. In their first days of life, babies also are tested, often with a blood sample drawn from a heel prick, for a host of rare diseases that respond to early intervention. These tests can change a child's life. Exactly which conditions they are tested for varies from state to state. Pennsylvania tests for 38 rare diseases, while Alaska tests for only 32, according to the National Organization for Rare Disorders, NORD, an advocacy group. State testing has become more uniform over the past 15 years because of something called the Recommended Uniform Screening Panel, which specifies which diseases states include in their testing panels. The HHS secretary decides what diseases are added to the list each year, usually adding 1 or 2 based on the recommendations of the Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children. This committee decides to add new diseases if there is a screening test that can be used at population scale and if a treatment is available. Though the advisory committee is made up almost entirely of volunteers, meaning it did not cost the governments much money, it was disbanded by the Trump administration April 3, says a spokesperson for NORD. The advisory committee was set to vote May 9 whether to recommend adding 2 rare genetic diseases to the panel, metachromatic leukodystrophy, MLD, and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Now the advocates who spent years advocating for those diseases to be added have no remedy. The longer it is delayed before these conditions are screened at the state level, the more children are potentially born with these conditions and do not get the opportunity to be identified and access care, says Allison Herity, Senior Policy Analyst at NORD. Screening for disorders is essential because in the past few years, treatments like gene therapy have become available to treat children early in life, Herity says. HHS did not respond to a request for comment about the layoffs at EHDI or about the dissolution of the advisory committee. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. has said publicly some staff cuts were made in error and those staff would be restored. But there's been no movement to restore either newborn screening program, according to current and former employees. The D.C. Brief by Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent. Alyssa Slotkin knows something about strategy. The Michigan senator worked for George W. Bush's National Security Council and Barack Obama's Departments of State and Defense before winning a Michigan congressional seat in 2018. After winning her Senate seat in a rare, bright spot for Democrats, Slotkin is applying her strategic thinking to how her party can best fight Donald Trump. Question. This is a question-answer format, only 1, 2, 3, 4 questions. Do Democrats have a plan for countering Trump? Answer, I don't think it is a secret that Democrats have been on their heels since Trump was elected. I constantly am looking for a strong, comprehensive strategy. It cannot be kind of reacting every single day to every single thing he does. Question, what should the plan be? Answer, I think most Americans who voted for President Trump voted for him because they wanted more money in their pockets. They did not vote for chaos. They did not vote for the instability he has created. They did not vote for cuts to veterans. They did not vote for will he, won't he on tariffs. Certainly in my state, it was an economic security vote. We need to spend time clearly articulating that he is going to make you pay in every corner of your life. People may be okay in theory with some of the DOGE cuts, but they certainly understand their family budget, and they understand what they are spending on groceries. They understand there's no plan for their mortgage or their rent. They understand the tariffs could cost them money. They understand their Medicaid, their Medicare, their Social Security, their VA benefits are being looked at as a potential area to cut. Whatever we do has to be pushing back on the complete fallacy that he is going to save you money. He is going to cost you money. He may create a self-inflicted recession. Question, do you feel like the party is not meeting the moment right now? Answer, I think Trump is very effectively flooding the zone. I think he has people on their heels. People do not know where to look first on any given day. Question, if you had a magic wand and could remake the party to be able to win again in places like Michigan, how would you have the party change? Answer, I think we need to get back to the fundamentals. The middle class is an absolutely essential part of American life. We need to grow and expand it. We need to focus on the three big things most Americans can agree on, which is strong economic security, strong national security, and strong democracy. I come from a world of war planning, a world of constant, prudent planning. I come from a world where you cannot just play defense only. There is no such thing as winning in any operation or in any war by just playing defense. The View essay, Immigration is the heading, Fear of the Other in a Nation of Immigrants by Viet Thanh Nguyen. Nguyen is author of To Save and to Destroy, writing as an other. A photo here of a group of people standing in front of a backdrop of brownish green mountains, with each person's right hand raised, and there's a U.S. flag in front of them, and there's no caption. The U.S. has always had a tricky relationship with immigrants and refugees. Even if part of the American mythology is that we are a land of newcomers, in this mythology, they, migrants, are part of us. At the same time, the U.S. has also gone through periodic spasms of intense anti-immigrant feeling. So it is now, with the Trump administration promoting a moral panic about strangers coming to our shores. When these people, including those who are also Americans, become seen as a threat to the nation, they're no longer part of us. Instead, they become the other to our collective self as a country. This is not new. In the late 1800s, many Americans believed Chinese immigrants brought disease, crime, and vice, along with an inhuman work ethic. The result was the burning of Chinatowns, the lynching of Chinese immigrants, the banning of most Chinese immigration. With his tariffs, President Donald Trump may yet target the Chinese even more explicitly than when he characterized COVID-19 as the Kung Flu. But in 2015, he campaigned on sealing American borders to protect the nation against Mexican rapists, and in 2025 against alleged Venezuelan gangsters. His promised deportation campaign recalls the 1920s and 1930s, when the government indiscriminately rounded up roughly 1 million Mexicans and Mexican-American citizens and dispatched them to Mexico. Punishing this other takes the form of theater and spectacle, meant to entertain and satisfy some while silencing and disciplining the rest. Thus, renditioning Venezuelans to El Salvador on flights operated by ICE is flaunted before cameras that record them as subhuman, heads shaved bald, anonymous, humiliated in infantilizing uniforms of white shirts and shorts. Renditioning is a more appropriate word than deportation, since many people are being returned not to their country of origin, but somewhere else. It also evokes suspected terrorists vanished by the CIA into so-called black sites, which suits how Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, a wartime authority last used to intern Japanese immigrants and Japanese American citizens in World War II, to describe alleged Venezuelan gangsters as terrorists who are infiltrating the U.S. Presidents and states describing alleged criminals as terrorists should frighten us all, because the terrorist is a name of infinite flexibility that can be applied to anyone who the state says is subverting it. Terror is an unending wellspring embodied by actual threats, but also coming from within us and giving birth to ever new demons. President George W. Bush's war on terror might have resonated with Americans because terror has been a part of American life since the first European settlers came to these shores. Perhaps the first terrifying others for these settlers were the indigenous peoples, followed by the kidnapped and enslaved Africans whose labor and bodies made the U.S. possible. Or perhaps the first other was the vast land itself, promising bounty and threatening disaster. What the philosopher Immanuel Levinas called the face of the other could elicit feelings of compassion or terror. These polar opposite reactions continue to define our American political and cultural landscape. While some call for empathy for others, the Trump administration casts these gestures as part of a diversity, equity, inclusion ideology that must be destroyed. Levinas thought the face-to-face encounter with one's other was a crucial ethical task. Elon Musk says the fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy, opening it to be taken over by non-Western and non-white people. Those sent to El Salvador's prison are paraded with their heads forcibly bowed. We are not allowed to see their very human faces. It is not simply gangsters who are terrorists in the imagination that fears the other. It is also refugees and immigrants, documented and undocumented, who are said to be seeking to replace white people. Their difference from the norms of the nation, white, male, heterosexual, Christian, seemingly precludes them from the right to dissent that is supposed to be a part of Americanism. All of the international students who've so far been arrested and detained incommunicado for protesting what they argue is Israel's genocidal attack on Gaza are non-white. Whether or not one agrees with what they say, as permanent legal residents and international students, they too have free speech rights protected by the U.S. Constitution. But it is worth asking how much separates a citizen from a Columbia graduate, Mahmoud Khalil, who's a permanent legal resident, or Tufts graduate student, Rumeysa Öztürk, an international student, arrested by masked ICE officers who barely deign to show identification or badges. An erosion of those rights can be extended to citizens as well, as the line is blurred between arresting and kidnapping, between official police and secret police. We, citizen or non-citizen, are meant to be intimidated. We are meant to submit to power, to any masked person saying they're the law. The mechanism is of power based on paranoia, one threat metastasizing and expanding. The Trump administration's crusade against pro-Palestinian students, for example, is enmeshed with its argument that it's defending Jewish people on and off campuses. But this is a weaponization of anti-Semitism, turning a very real racism into a tool to advance a political agenda, whereby Palestinians become the new others, temporarily replacing Jewish people as perpetual others. Pushing assorted others quells empathy and dissent. Punishing assorted others quells empathy and dissent. For we do not want to be targeted ourselves. Documented immigrants condoning the deportation of undocumented immigrants is an example of those who might be considered other turning against those who already are marked as others. This is a classic divide-and-conquer political strategy. The Trump administration methodically attacks university after university, law firm after law firm, immigrant group after immigrant group, individual after individual. The lesson is that we are not safer by sacrificing others. Authoritarian power will not be satisfied with one sacrifice or one enemy or one other, but will require more, since that power thrives on the spectacle of punishment. Each punishment diminishes the ability of everyone else to resist that power. Meanwhile, the more power that authoritarianism accrues in its willingness to break any rule or law, the less power there is in those rules and laws to protect us. The solution to such an approach has always been the same, but bears repeating. Unity is our only hope, solidarity our primary strategy. We must refuse to be divided. Even as we're offered the temptation of sacrificing others, or the bargain of giving up one right after another in the hopes of securing safety from unending terror. We are at a moment now where Trump's pursuing the idea of eroding, even ending, birthright citizenship and embracing the idea of sending homegrown Americans to El Salvador's prisons. His administration is also seeking an expansion of a for-profit immigrant detention system with a budget of $45 billion. When do detention camps become concentration camps, which is what Franklin Delano Roosevelt initially called the places where Japanese Americans were interned? At what point will enough of us say, enough? What might destroy our society is not immigrants or refugees or Palestinians or women seeking abortions or trans people or any of the other assorted others that have been posited as undermining American society. What might destroy us is our own fear, not just of the other who's a neighbor and a stranger, but of ourselves, of that black hole of abiding mysteries within us that so many of us cannot solve on our own. What might help us overcome that fear and terror is not to banish others, but to keep company with them, to speak with them, to meet them face to face. And turning the page again, here's Pope Francis, a very similar portrait to the one found on the cover, except it's in profile from the right, and it is just his head and collar. Pope Francis, Remembrance, 1936 to 2025. An Argentine with a gift for empathy, a discomfort with opulence, and a profound love for the poor, changed the face of the Catholic Church. This is by Olivia B. Waxman. Additional reporting is by Solcira Burga, Chad de Guzman, Miranda Jaretnam, and Simone Shaw. I'm going to abbreviate this because we know the rest of the story to some extent already. This edition of Time having been published May 12, or that's the publication date, it was written and prepared before that. So, abbreviating some of the remembrance to Pope Francis, he was a departure. Francis was the first pope from the Americas, the first, in fact, from anywhere but Europe. There had been 265 before him, but no one had taken his name from St. Francis of Assisi, famous for ministering to the poor. Until his death, April 21, at age 88, the first Pope Francis was known for his willingness to hear out different views on controversial issues, marriage, sexuality, the priesthood, that predecessors had been unwilling to debate. Though the Church's corrosive, long-denied child sex abuse scandal had created a crisis of conscience, particularly among young Catholics, Francis exuded a level of empathy, humility, and mercy that people felt connected to in a way they said they had not with past pontiffs. He served credibly as the world's conscience. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Francis urged Vladimir Putin to stop this spiral of violence and death. While hospitalized for the pneumonia that nearly killed him in March, he kept up regular weekly chats aimed at comforting a Catholic parish in Gaza. As Time explained in choosing Francis as its 2013 Person of the Year, he changed the tone and perception and focus of one of the world's largest institutions in an extraordinary way. Jorge Mario Bergoglio was born December 17, 1936, in Buenos Aires, Argentina's capital city. the eldest of accountant Mario Bergoglio and Regina Sivori's five children. His parents were Italian immigrants who'd fled Benito Mussolini's fascist regime. And his grandmother, Rosa Margherita Vassallo de Bergoglio, was active in Catholic Action, formed by Italian bishops who wanted to maintain their independence from Mussolini's authoritarian rule. His grandmother had the biggest influence on him, according to biographer Austin Ivory, who wrote in Wounded Shepherd, Pope Francis and His Struggle to Convert the Catholic Church, that it was an austere but happy lower-middle-class family life. Grandma Bergoglio would take him to Mass, educated him about the saints and the rosary, and introduced him and his siblings to Italian literature and his favorite novel, Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed. His family retained their love for Italian culture, and Bergoglio grew up listening to opera and watching every Italian movie that came to town. His love for soccer dates back to this period when he followed the small Buenos Aires soccer team, San Lorenzo, with his father. As a preteen, he wrote to a girl, "If I don't become a priest, I'll marry you." At 16, he was en route to meet classmates from the vocational school where he studied chemistry when he passed San Jose de Flores Church. He went into the confessional booth and came out of it convinced he should become a priest. "I felt I had to enter. It was one of those things one feels inside and one does not know why," he said in a 2012 Buenos Aires radio interview. He ended up going home instead of going out with his friends because he felt overwhelmed. Yet it was not until 4 days before his 33rd birthday that he was ordained with the Society of Jesus, better known as the Jesuits. A measure of the openness Francis would display as Pope can be traced to unpopular decisions he made as leader of the order in Argentina. During the country's so-called Dirty War, two Jesuits serving in slums were among those seen as rebels. After a military coup in 1976, they were kidnapped and tortured. Bergoglio was accused of not doing all he could to protect them, and though he testified that he had met military officers privately and pressed for their release, after becoming Pope, he admitted he had regrets about the way he handled the situation. While serving as rector of the Colegio de San Jose in Buenos Aires, he had his students work on farms, harvesting crops and milking cows to feed the city's poor. This made him unpopular among those who emphasized more classroom time, and he was eventually forced out of the role. He spent 2 years living in a tiny room in a Jesuit residence, essentially in exile, a time of great interior crisis, he said. But in 1992, Pope John Paul II named Bergoglio auxiliary bishop in Buenos Aires on the recommendation of the city's Archbishop Antonio Coracino, to whom he had grown close. He succeeded Coracino in 1998, became a cardinal in 2001, was Buenos Aires Archbishop on February 11, 2013, when Pope Benedict XVI became the first pope in 600 years to retire. The College of Cardinals elected him March 13 on the fifth ballot in one of the fastest papal conclaves. Clearly the cardinals were looking for something and someone different, so his very otherness may have been appealing, James Martin, the Jesuit priest and editor-at-large at America, wrote for Time 2 days later. On the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, as he addressed the crowd, Pope Francis joked about his Latin American origins. It seemed, he said, the cardinals had to go to the ends of the earth to find a pope. but often someone from the margins is just what the center needs. Pope Francis grappled with the child sex abuse scandals that have been a stain on the Catholic Church for decades. Early on, he made the claim, "No one else has done more than the Church in cracking down on pedophiles in the clergy," hailing its transparency. He also stood by Juan Barros, the Chilean bishop accused of covering up for a mentor found guilty of sexually abusing minors. Francis called the cover-up accusation a calumny and called for a Vatican investigation. After listening to dozens of testimonies, however, he publicly apologized. "I was part of the problem," Francis reportedly told Chilean victims of sexual abuse who visited the Vatican. In February 2019, he defrocked Theodore McCarrick, an ex-cardinal accused of sexual abuse, and to enable clergy to report sex abuse claims to law enforcement, he nixed a 2001 decree that had allowed church officials to classify such allegations as pontifical secrets. Living up to Francis of Assisi's recognition as the patron saint of ecology and the poor, ahead of the Paris Climate Accords, the late pontiff released a groundbreaking June 2015 encyclical, arguing climate change was undeniable and disproportionately hits developing countries. Pope Francis also tried to repair the Church's relations with indigenous groups, embarking on a week-long pilgrimage of penance in Canada to publicly apologize for residential boarding schools run by church missionaries, notorious for decades of physical and emotional abuse. "I am here to remember the past and to cry with you," he told survivors. His modest lifestyle was also part of this pope's appeal. He chose to live in a penthouse apartment in St. Martha's House, regarding the apostolic palace as too extravagant. Noting that bishops must be servants, he famously washed the feet of inmates of local jails. "People will approach me to say I've been away from the church for a year, but Pope Francis is drawing me back." Or, "I'm not a Catholic, but I sure love this pope," Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, said in 2018. A decade before his health collapsed, Francis also talked openly about dying. Asked on a 2014 flight from South Korea to the Vatican how he felt about global fame, he told reporters, "I try to think of my sins, my mistakes, not to become proud, because I know it will last only a short time, 2 or 3 years, and then I'll be off to the Father's house." The Times staff has prepared an article entitled "On to the Conclave: The Next Pope Will Emerge in a Process Combining Strict Rules, Subtle Politics, and a Puff of Smoke." That conclave has already begun and ended, so I'm not going to read very much of this article. I'll read a few paragraphs and end with Time's list of the possible next pontiff. As the world mourned Pope Francis and commemorated his legacy, the Sede Vacante, or vacant seat at the Vatican, kick-started a leadership transition period known as the Papal Interregnum, when there's no pope in place. For a span of weeks, ultimate power in the church will roil quietly among the College of Cardinals, who gather in Rome to secretly decide the next pontiff. The origins of the process date to the 13th century, anchoring papal succession in equal parts tradition, real politic, and mystery. Electors vote secretly by filling in cards reading "Eligo in summum pontificem," or "I elect as supreme pontiff." The ballots are folded twice and placed in urns before being counted. Three cardinals record each vote and the tallies read aloud. The process continues till a candidate receives two-thirds of the vote. A maximum of four votes are held per day. The public's kept abreast of the voting process through smoke signals created by burning the ballots. White smoke means the cardinals have selected a new pope, while black smoke means another round of voting has to take place. Who will it be this time? Prognosticators around the globe have readied their forecasts. Here are six people named by Time as the possible next pontiff. All are cardinals, obviously. Luis Antonio Tagle, 67, Philippines. Peter Erdo, 72, Hungary. Jean-Marc Aveline, 66, France. Pietro Parolin, 70, Italy. Juan Jose Omella, 79, Spain. Matteo Maria Zuppi, 69, Italy. Missing from that list is Robert Prevost of Chicago. And there is another photograph, I guess, of Pope Francis. It seems he's walking away into the black. One sees that beautiful capelet over his shoulders and the long robe and the white skullcap. Next is five questions. Dr. Peter Marks, a longtime head of vaccine and drug approval at the FDA on measles, missed opportunities, and resigning. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yep, five questions. This article is written by Alice Park, and it is in the question-answer format. Dr. Mark's photograph is not a very large one, but it shows his head and his shoulders, and he's got short-cropped gray hair that's kind of falling into his face, and he's wearing glasses, and he's wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and striped tie. Marks served in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for 13 years, most of them as director of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, overseeing the review and approval of vaccines, including the COVID-19 shots, and biologic therapies. The FDA is under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, headed by vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. March 28, Marks resigned after he says he was pressed by officials at HHS to come in line with skepticism about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines or be fired. Question, how concerned are you about the current measles outbreak in the U.S.? Answer, I was so disturbed when I heard about the second measles death in a child that I used profanity with a reporter without realizing it. I was so disturbed and remain disturbed because this is absolutely needless. Question, you worked under both Democratic and Republican administrations, including during Donald Trump's first term. Why is this term so different? Following the transition to the current administration, an increasingly anti-vaccine tone became apparent. This became obvious in a variety of different ways, including from discussions of administration concerns regarding adverse event reporting, the desire to reanalyze safety data that had already been well adjudicated and published, and the tepid federal response to the ongoing serious outbreak of measles. I tried diligently to meet the new administration halfway and was hoping we could engage in scientific dialogue and work through the issues, but it was clear that new leadership at FDA and HHS did not want to engage. Then over the 2 weeks prior to the time I was essentially forced to resign from my position, there were an increasing number of actions taken based on incorrect or frankly false assumptions that were clearly anti-vaccine in nature. These were inconsistent with both the best available science and truly advancing public health. Nothing like this ever transpired during the first Trump administration. Question, how did you try to work with the new administration on vaccines? Answer, I was hopeful and tried to put together a package of things we could do to hopefully try to address issues related to vaccines with a proposal that ended up with 4 points. One, we would hold listening meetings to hear from individuals about their concerns regarding vaccine components and the safety and efficacy of vaccines and how they're labeled. Second, we would ask the National Academy of Medicine to study any appropriate issues, such as if people are worried about vaccine adjuvants, which help to boost the immune response. Number three, we propose to revise how we report on vaccine adverse events so it's more transparent. The fourth thing was that we could go back to revisit vaccine labels. Vaccine labeling over the course of several decades has gotten very messy, and the information for patients is not as clear as it could be. That is a legitimate criticism. Question, did you receive any response or feedback to the proposal? Answer, no. I did not get anything back. Question, what is your reaction to the new investigation into the link between measles vaccine, MMR, and autism? Answer, measles vaccine is one of the safest, most effective vaccines we have. Unlike other vaccines, which you might be able to argue about whether people should take them or not, the measles vaccine that has been given to children saves lives. 1 in 1,000 children who get measles dies up front. Another 1 in 10,000 to 20,000 children dies a few years later from persistent measles infection in the brain. So it saves lives. The measles vaccine is not associated with death, encephalitis, autism, or long-term adverse effects. And that was Alice Parks' interview with Dr. Peter Marks. Time Off Reviews Movies, A Man Who Cannot Make Friends, played for laughs, by Stephanie Zakarik. This will be considerably abridged. Tim Robinson, the former Saturday Night Live writer and performer, who now co-stars with Paul Rudd in the prickly cringe comedy Friendship, is probably a genius, both here and in his popular Netflix sketch series, I Think You Should Leave. He specializes in a kind of auteurist awkwardness, playing the zonked out but subliminally angry guy who has precisely the wrong quip for every occasion, whose facial expressions never quite match the sentiments coming from his mouth, whose rubbery body language seems to follow rhythms beamed from another planet. I Think You Should Leave is theater of the absurd, broken into small bites of aggro humor. Robinson as a guy who gets caught looking at a nude egg on his work computer, as a witless nerd who asks his barber for a Bryan Cranston haircut and gets a Springer Spaniel do instead, as a low-rent stage performer who specializes in gentle Charlie Chaplin-style comedy, only to blow his top when frat boys heckle him at his shows. It makes little sense on paper, but Robinson creates a believable, if bizarre, micro-world for each character. He's like Zippy the Pinhead for the modern age, a naive weirdo traveler out of step with the world. Friendship hinges on the sad truth it's hard for men to make friends, which may be why the film's earliest scenes in which Austin expresses genuine interest in hanging out with Craig, his social ineptitude, more a curiosity than a liability, work best. His sad sack woes pile up. It's not that Robinson is not subtle enough. There are moments when his inane gap-toothed smile nearly breaks your heart, even though, in a small, uncomfortable way, it also invites your contempt. The problem, really, is that the Tim Robinson of the 3 or 4 minute sketches of I Think You Should Leave is just the right amount of Tim Robinson, at least in this particular mode. It is why we drink liqueurs, digestifs, espresso, in tiny glasses or cups. The more intense the elixir, the less we can handle at once. Sometimes that goes for comic genius, too. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.